Ladies and gentlemen, here is James Geary.
Hello, everyone. Hello, everyone. Good evening. I'm going to talk to you about, hopefully you'll find the talk a little bit witty, but I won't be addressing wit directly, but I'll be addressing writing. And I want to start by telling you back in the day when I lived in San Francisco, I studied Chinese philosophy and Buddhism. I was attending a wonderfully named institute of higher learning called the California Institute of Integral Studies. Only in San Francisco could you have an institution of higher learning called the California Institute of Integral Studies. So I was studying Taoism, mostly, ancient Chinese philosophy, expressed in books like the I Ching, the Book of Changes, and the Tao Te Ching by Lao Tzu. And I was also studying the Chinese language. Now, I was studying all these subjects with a wonderful man named Yi Wu. He was a wise and insightful man, and we had class a couple times a week in his home, where he'd serve us tea and cookies. And one of the great educational experiences of my life was reading the I Ching and the Tao Te Ching in the original Chinese with the help of Yi Wu. Now, I confess I was a terrible student of the Chinese language. It's a really, really difficult language to learn, and I failed miserably at it. But I was able to read the I Ching and the Tao Te Ching in the original Chinese, character by character, because Chinese doesn't have an alphabet per se, it has individual characters. And these individual characters, even if you don't know how to pronounce the character itself, it's like a self-contained unit of meaning, unlike an individual letter in our alphabet. So you could follow the text with Yu's explanations just by understanding the meaning of the character. And some Chinese characters, one way of thinking about them is that they're beautiful, they're almost like poems, beautiful symbols and images of complex ideas. For example, the character for ask in Chinese is made up of the character for gate with a character for mouth inside it, a mouth at the gate. Listen is the character for gate with a character for ear inside it, an ear at the gate. And if you think about it, that's a beautiful image of, because our mouths and our ears are actual gates to our bodies and to our minds. And all these ideas are contained in the Chinese character. There's a Chinese character for wisdom, and that is made up of the character for a broom above the character for a heart. So in Chinese, wisdom is a clean swept heart. Beautiful idea. Now, some of the earliest Chinese characters are sort of like pictures of the things they're meant to represent. So this is a page from a book called Chinese Characters, Their Wit and Wisdom by a woman named Rose Kuang. It was published in 1968, and I came across it in a used bookshop in San Francisco. And I've been referring to it ever since. So you see at the top the character Ren, that means person. And it looks like a very simple stick figure drawing of a person. The character just below it, Da, means big. And it looks like a person with his arms outstretched. And the character below that is Tian, and that means sky or heaven. So what is big and above a person with his arms outstretched? Sky or heaven, Tian. Tiananmen Square. The gate of heavenly peace. An oxymoron since 1989. So my favorite Chinese character is Da. And it's my favorite character because it reminds me of my favorite word in English, which is fathom. Now, fathom originally meant, it's a measurement of water, really, of water depth. And it's basically 6 feet. But the original meaning of fathom was a person, it's an old Anglo-Saxon word, with his arms outstretched. Because the average length of a person with his arms outstretched is about 6 feet. And this was originally used as a measurement of cloth. So you can imagine people working with cloth and they need to measure it out. That's one fathom. That's two fathoms. This was carried over into measuring bodies of water because it's very easy to lower a rope over the side of a ship. And every 6 feet is a fathom. Mark Twain, he got his name. He worked on a riverboat, the Mississippi River, and Mark Twain is what they would call out when the water was 2 fathoms deep. That's 12 feet, and that's just enough for a steamboat to navigate the Mississippi River. That's where Mark Twain got his name. So you can see the relationship between da, big, and fathom, a measurement of water or cloth that's about 6 feet. Of course, today, very few people, unless you work on a steamboat on the Mississippi River, use fathom in its literal sense. Today, fathom means to understand. And we use it in phrases like, I can't fathom why she would have voted that way. or he's unfathomable. So, essentially, fathom has lost its original literal meaning and has become a pure metaphor. And that's very fitting because the way we measure things that we can't understand, the way that we get to grips with things, get our arms around things, take things in hand, grasp things, the way we get to the bottom of things is through metaphor. Now, I think maybe a lot of people tend to think that metaphor only happens in poets' poems by John Keats and things like that. But we actually use metaphors all the time. In almost, there's one study that found we use 6 metaphors a minute, but I think that's a gross underestimate. I would say we use far more. Are you guys feeling up tonight, or are you feeling down? Up. That's good. Thank you for that answer. Good is up. Bad is down. Are you looking forward to the drinks after the talks? Or yes, very good. So am I. Or will you look back on this evening with deep, deep regret? These are all metaphors. Up, down, forward, back. We use metaphors of physical space to describe what's going on psychologically in our head. So metaphors are what help us measure things that are too da, too big, to be otherwise explained. Now, the ancient Incas had a wonderful way to fathom just these kinds of very big things. This is called a quipu, and it's a way that the Incas kept records and kept narrative history. So you can see a quipu is made up of various kinds of colored strings, and at intervals along the string, there's little knots. Now, no one really knows how to fully translate quipus, but the theory is that they were used as, like I said, a record-keeping device to keep a record of transactions and things like that, how much grain you have, how much grain you gave to your neighbor, but also as a kind of narrative history and storytelling. And for me, writing is quipu. As a writer, what do? You string together anecdotes, episodes, stories into a longer narrative thread, and you weave those together into a story. Now, when I first learned about quipu, or since I first learned about quipu, I see them everywhere. I don't know if you have all seen, they're very popular where I live. There's these long ropes that daycare center staff use, and on the end of those ropes are like 6 or 8 little toddlers. And they're toddling along down the street on their way to the park or wherever they're going to play. It's a quipu. Each child on that string is just a bundle of unfolding stories, stories of what they will become, what will become of them. A laundry line is a kipu. It's dangling very personal, very intimate stories. Your favorite socks that you wear on every game day. Special tablecloth that you got from your grandmother that you only take out on special occasions and you wash by hand. A child's favorite blanket that you manage to wrest away from that child just long enough to wash the puke and the snot out of it. It's a kipu. So a couple weeks ago, I had the opportunity to visit Madison, Wisconsin, and I had some time, and so I took a walk around the town just to get to know it a little bit, and I ended up in a kind of combination visitor center terrace overlooking Lake Monona, which is one of the two lakes in between which Madison, Wisconsin finds itself. There was a plaque there at the spot where I was standing, and it was about Otis Redding. And in 1967, in December, Otis Redding and his band were in a little plane flying to Madison for a gig in bad weather. And the plane crashed in Lake Monona, and everyone on board died except Otis Redding's trumpet player. And this plaque commemorated Otis Redding's life and work. 1 month later, in January of 1968, Dock of the Bay appeared. And that was the first posthumous number one hit in US chart history, Otis Redding. So as I was standing on that terrace, I was looking directly down onto Lake Monona. And the lake was like a deep, dark, rich emerald green. And the sun was shining really, really brightly. And directly below me was a line of fishermen. And they were casting their lures out into the lake. And it looked exactly like that. It looked like a kipu. I could clearly see each individual line casting out into the lake, sinking down into the water, and the fishermen reeling it back. Writing is fishing. We cast our lines into unseen depths, hoping we'll catch something, hoping we can string together some images, some anecdotes, some stories that will help us measure those things in life that are really da, that are, in fact, sometimes unfathomable. Thank you so much.
Okay.